Hello, everyone. Welcome to another Amherst Reed interview. I am thrilled to be back doing another one. This is Ron Lieber from the class of 93, and today I am with my classmate, Ted Lee, class of 93, on the occasion of the publication with his brother, Matt, of Hot Box, Inside Catering, the Food World's Riskiest Business. Ted, thank you for joining the call.
Thank you so much. Thank you for doing this. I'm thrilled to be here.
Hot Box is incredible. I literally woke up in the middle of the night to read it. It was so exciting. It unfolds practically like a documentary, which is rare for narrative nonfiction. I find myself imagining what the filmed version of this would look like, and I'll ask you questions about it later.
Yeah.
But let's start by going back to your roots, your culinary roots, your geographic roots in particular, your family roots. Ted, what did you know and what did you think you knew about food when you showed up at Amherst College in the fall of 1989?
That's a great question, because what I knew of food when I landed on Amherst was really growing up in South Carolina, growing up in Charleston, where the food culture is very close at hand. As a kid, you know where the fig trees are. You know where the mulberry trees are. You know how to tie a drop line and catch crabs off a dock. You know how to throw a cast net if you're a talented teenager. But these things, you don't necessarily think of them as food experiences necessarily, but you grow up with acculturated knowledge of where food comes from and that sort of thing. And then so you arrive at Amherst, and you sort of find out that it's different. The food culture of the Pioneer Valley was different. I also hadn't grown up going to a cafeteria, like that kind of thing in school. My dad mostly packed bag lunches. So that was a new thing. The whole Valentine, three times a day in the dining hall was mind-blowing. It was like the coolest thing I'd ever seen.
Uh-huh.
But it was a little intimidating at the same time, eating... with people, so many people. That's the other, you have to understand, coming from South Carolina, my graduating high school class was 60 people. So, to me, Amherst was huge.
Mm-hmm. So there was something about the scale.
A lot of things about the scale and sort of adjusting to the food system of a college that were really new and kind of intimidating, but very alluring. Because I did, as I think you may know, I ended up working in Valentine.
Mm-hmm.
Not on the preparation side, rather in the dish pit.
And tell me how that happened, right? Because I don't know if that's a job that you chose or whether that job chose you. It is not the easiest work study job on the Amherst College campus.
It was really just to make spending money. I wasn't on financial aid, so that was a great help, but I still needed to, get through. And so it sort of started as a challenge because I didn't love being around that whole world of industrialized food delivery systems, and sort of a little bit repulsed at the same time. I love food, and I don't know, I just was like, I need to be there. I want to get there. I did also like the teamwork. I loved the interaction with people. I love the work. Labor has always been not afraid of rolling up my sleeves and getting into it. And that I worked at a few jobs, and then I ended up working a shift with Sarah Miller from the class of 91,
mm-hmm.
and I was like, this is so fun. We had a radio, we had, trash talking people.
Mm-hmm. And Sarah's someone else who grew up to make a living with words, is that right?
Yes, mm-hmm. She's a writer as well. I hadn't sort of, made that connection between the East dining hall dish pit and the writing world, but yeah, she's a fabulous writer. She just wrote a big piece for, I think, New York or... somewhere. Amazing. Anyhow, I love the culture of it. I loved the work and the labor, and I really liked sort of getting involved. I remember I was a really annoying kid that, worked the dining hall, but also, petitioned the dining hall to make balsamic vinaigrette available in all the dining rooms.
I was that person, too.
We were those assholes, right?
Yeah. Did you actually join the committee to give Valentine's suggestions when we were seniors? We may have been at those meetings.
Yes, I think we were.
Which suggestions did they take you up on?
They did make balsamic vinaigrette available all the time, which...
That was a win in 1990.
Which was totally a win, and then we got sick of it. And I was like, oh, my God, get this stuff out of here.
And what tended to come back uneaten most often? Do you remember what you scraped the most of off of those plates?
Well, that's the other thing, and it sort of comes around, dovetails with sort of the catering. And I was so shocked by how much food gets wasted.
Mm-hmm.
It's skipping ahead through a few lives to the catering thing, but that's the the down outside of industrialized, I mean, not industrialized, but like commercial food systems, is that there's a tremendous amount of waste.
And, yeah. So other food-related things that you were up to outside of the classroom, and on the topic of things that did not come back uneaten, you were one of the original proprietors of the Hungry Newt, am I right?
Oh, my gosh, you remember that, too. Yeah,
right?
The Hungry Newt.
Which
is Stephanie Rentz and all these great women, mostly.
Right.
I was one of a few guys on this Hungry Newt, and it was like a coffee house that ran out of what's now Schwemm's, I think.
Yep. With papers that were so good that you eventually published your own cookbook, right? It was kind of a stapled together thing. I still have it. I meant to bring it.
I don't even have that. I'll give you a certain amount of money for it. So I learned how to bake from those women, and it was extraordinary, just, going from a position not knowing, I was part of the food economy of my family because mostly I helped my dad do the shopping, but I had not spent a lot of time baking. I was a frustrated, like, anything with exactitude was not my jam. I was more like the,
Ripping
a bunch of shrimp, and peeling each shrimp, but, shucking your own oysters was my thing. So to learn at the Hungry Newt that, like, I could make a banana nut muffin, and people would, like, love it if you had the right recipe. I mean, that was the thing. And then...
Is that where you wrote your first recipe, basically, for the Hungry Newt, or was it a mile after that?
I don't know if I wrote any of them. I wrote my first recipes, truly, like, wrote them down and starting to work right about food for the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because in that day, you sort of had to, you would interview a chef, and then they would give you a recipe, their, quote-unquote recipe, like something scribbled on the back of a napkin, and say, here's my recipe. And you'd be like, that's not going to work in the times. And it's like, well, you do something and figure it out. And, you sort of do that recipe manipulation and you get excited by it. And, I had various mentors in my life. I have an uncle who was a restaurateur who I worked for when I was growing up, not in the kitchen, but I just sort of being geeked out on what happened in the kitchen is so part of my process. Unfortunately, I had a brother who was also likewise interested, and so we did a bunch of cookbooks and wrote a bunch of recipes.
Yeah. So Ted, you graduate from the esteemed Iowa Writers' Workshop. It's a great place to be from if you're trying to sell your first novel, but maybe not so much if food writing is your jam. How did you make the transition?
The Iowa Writers' Workshop, I loved it. It was like a 2-year sabbatical from another chapter of this weird life. That was like before we started writing for the Times. My brother and I started a boiled peanuts catalog, selling boiled peanuts by mail order and other Southern staples. Like all the things we missed when he was at Harvard and I was at Amherst because we couldn't find them, right?
I think that was the first place I ever was able to purchase Duke's mayo. Is that a possibility?
Yes. By mail order. And so we had that catalog going, and then I took a sabbatical from that to indulge what I'd done actually as, my senior thesis at Amherst was a collection of 3 short stories and a memoir. And so I wanted to go back to that, went to Iowa, and then in my second year in Iowa, which I loved, I just loved everything about that 2-year experience, but that's a sort of hiatus from the matters at hand. Writing fiction was such a solitary thing. And it was really required for me, at least. I had friends like ZZ Packer. She could go to a cafe and write a novel, but I couldn't do that. And so I was thinking, maybe this isn't going to work out. It's like, being around people too much. And so that my second year, it just so happened that a magazine editor at Travel and Leisure, who'd been a customer of the Boiled Peanuts catalog, said, would you want to write a story about traveling South Carolina, showing us, your suppliers for the catalog and, write about what it's like to travel around a part of South Carolina our readers don't know, namely the upstate, which I didn't know a lot about because I grew up in Charleston. And we're very sort of chauvinistic. We think Charleston's the best place. And so we got what at the time was an insane amount of money because magazines still did that at the time. To travel around for 9 days in upstate South Carolina and write about it. It was the best thing I'd ever done.
And what was
so
insane money in those days? Like $4 a word or something?
It was 3,000 words and $3 a word, maybe even 3.5. So it was like $10,000. And that didn't even include the budget they gave you, which was literally enough to buy a house in upstate South Carolina. I mean, it's crazy. So that was a thing that we were just like, we got on board. That's when we started. I think we literally sent that clip to the local paper in Charleston saying, oh, look, we got a clip. Like, we want to start writing about food. And we never heard back from them. So we sent that same list of pitches to Michaeline Buzico at the New York Times, where we are recording this, you know, and they said, who are you? We haven't heard of any of these things. So we want all of them. And like, let's do this. So,
Brilliant. So
that's how we got to write about food and travel.
Right. And Ted, let's take a quick pause and talk
sure.
about the we. Why work with your brother? I mean, I can think of a few romantic partnerships and folks who've written about food together over the years, but no sibling acts. Was it just sort of a natural outgrowth of the business, or was it something deliberate?
It was a natural outgrowth of the business. You know, we first were asked by Travel and Leisure, like, we know your catalog. Will you do this? And so somehow the sibling byline became a thing, and then nobody wanted us individually. It was like, well, you know, are you both going to do it? And I don't know, we ended up working together pretty well. You know, it's not collaboration, as I'm sure you know, on things is not always easy.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's a family member, there's sort of more, you know, it's easier to get frustrated and still, you know,
mm-hmm.
move on.
Yeah. All right.
And
so
not take things personally.
Yeah. So you fast forward to, you know, one thing leads to another. You put out several cookbooks with major
yeah.
publishers. You win all the prizes, including the James Beard More Than Once, which is sort of the Oscars of the food world.
Right.
Did you decide that there was just nothing left to do in recipe land? Had you been looking for a nonfiction narrative opportunity, storytelling opportunity, other than your own story to tell all along?
We were at that point where it's like the publisher wanted us to slice the Southern pie thinner. Like, oh, you've done the, like, all over the South Southern cookbook. You've done the quick, simple, fresh Southern. You've done the Charleston kitchen. Now maybe do a grilling book, Southern grilling, or do bacon, like ham. And we were just like, you know what? There are a lot of stories coming out of the South that are worthy to tell, but we're not the people to tell those. You know, white middle-aged guys. There's so many stories to come out of the South. At the same time, we happened to have an experience where we were doing an event at the James Beard House, where we were just observing a friend of ours who's a restaurant chef in Atlanta doing an event at the James Beard House in New York City, which is the event venue that the James Beard Foundation runs, hosting chefs from out of town every night. And every time they're going into that kitchen, it's a pretty challenging kitchen. It's not, you know, it's like they're producing like super high-end food out of a kitchen in a Greenwich Village townhouse that was never meant to be a commercial kitchen. And it's tiny and it's hot and it's crazy. And so my friend from Atlanta, the chef, had brought in three men who were chefs from the world of catering. And they rolled into that kitchen to assist him. They'd never cooked with him before. They'd never cooked that food before. They'd never been in that kitchen before. They showed up at 5 p.m., kind of like culinary special ops. And they just, like, crushed it. They knocked it out of the park. They worked in a way that was so intuitive and so impressive and resourceful that we were just like, and they, on the other hand, when, you know, when we went for beers afterwards and said, you guys are amazing. Like, how'd you do that? They said, that was only 70 covers.
That was
75 people. I mean, that may have been five courses, sure, but like 75 people is nothing. Like our nightly is like 750. We start sweating. And then we were like, but what about that kitchen? That kitchen was so small. And they were like, but there was a kitchen.
Right.
You had electricity,
yeah.
A gas line, you had running water. Like that was a dream for us because every night when we're doing the gala for 850 people, we're rolling into the loading dock at the MoMA, which is our quote-unquote kitchen. We're, you know, shooing the, like, rodents and the stomping on the palmetto bugs and cockroaches, and we're building the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. So your head explodes, right?
Our head explodes.
Immediately.
Totally,
you're like, you've got
totally.
A thousand questions.
Like, here's a hidden
right.
kitchen in plain sight. And,
yeah.
you know, I've been to a few of these events. You know, my wife is an artist based in New York. We
yeah.
go to these galas,
mm-hmm.
and I never really think about that's a food experience. And a lot of times it's extraordinary, and you're
yeah.
sort of like, wow, this is impressive for, you know, there's 600 people here. I'm eating a delicious piece of fish.
Mm-hmm.
How did this happen? Who knows?
Yeah.
And I wanted to know, and I felt like I'd, you know, it's funny. Matt and I wrote a column that was our best gig we ever did for the New York Times called The Industry. And it was like, these stories about the food industry that you never knew, you know, these jobs in the food industry you never knew existed, like a tomato breeder, a flavoring salesman, the kitchen porter at Danielle Restaurant, you know, in New York, the cake mover, the person who takes the cake from, that was the closest catering we got. We rolled along with her when she moved the cake from the baker, you know, it's like a $5,000 cake, from that baker studio in Tribeca to Queens, like over the potholes and everything, to the site and dropped it off. And it's as heavy as like a couch. And there's a person, a cake mover. So, but we never thought about catering in that way. And I think because there is this prejudice that, you know, catering is sort of like its lowest expectations. You know, you scale up the food. If you scale up the food, you're going to lose something. It just doesn't become interesting. But it was only because of our perspective and our prejudice that we felt that way. And as soon as we got to know the people who work in business, like,
characters everywhere.
Characters are everywhere.
Yeah. But, so you mentioned almost right off the bat in the book that Amerson helped you get started with the research. I'm going to take a guess and say that was Andy Booth, class 91.
No, it wasn't Andy Booth.
Because he worked in special events for years, I thought.
It was Andy. It was a friend of Matt. It was Meg Gleason from Harvard. Yeah, it was a friend of Matt from Harvard.
Okay.
But that's a great point that I should have reached out to Andy because he...
Well, at the very least, you should send him a book if he doesn't have one already.
I know. That's so funny because I think of him as being on the, you know, the other side of it, like the florals and decor and music and all that kind of thing, but this is totally his work.
Ah, so that was one Matt chapter, not
yeah, that was
chapter.
From a Matt chapter, yeah.
Gotcha. So were the two of you expecting to have to go to work? I mean, did you think this was going to be participatory? Because right away, you sort of hit the line and
that was
started chopping and scrubbing and...
Patrick was very solicitous. He was like, if you want to...
I'm sorry, Patrick is one of the main characters of the book.
Patrick, so the three men who we met that night at the James Beard House were Patrick Phelan, the executive chef at a firm called Sonier & Castle. He was executive chef at the time. He's now moved on. And his two best lead chefs, who were brothers, Juan and Jorge Soto, these brothers who...
Yeah, incredible characters.
Amazing characters, amazing workers. There's so much talent and so much intuitive knowledge about that. Cooking proteins at scale. And Patrick said, you know, we kept saying like, well, maybe we'll follow you around, maybe write a story. And, you know, he was like, I don't think it's going to work. I think you're going to have to join the team. And didn't hear from him for a while and was worried that maybe he talked to his boss and got spooked. And then one day he just called and said, dude, I need you in this kitchen. Like, I was like, well, don't you want to know, like, my knife skills, like, all this kind of stuff. He's like, do you have two hands? Get over here. And that's kind of the way it works in catering. Is it's a very fluid labor situation. It's an accordion business, right? So any catering business, they might have one party Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, but then Thursday is three, Friday might be four, and Saturday might be three in the Hamptons.
Yep.
And then there might be some on Sunday, too.
Yeah. No. So everyone's a freelancer. You can work as much or as little as
you want. Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's crazy that way. I hadn't really been in a, it ended up being great for the research because we didn't want to be like these guys who were like doing a book. We just wanted to work and see what that was like and drop into the culture and try to live it as to the extent that we could.
Yes.
And it was very easy because we could do that and then you'd disappear for 2 months because we had our other jobs that we hustled that we do on the side. And then you come back and people would be like, I hadn't seen you in a couple of months. You've been working for, you know.
Right. Yeah.
You know, you just pick up and they're just like, you know, help me box this table out. You know, just, it was really intense in that way. Like, you could work as much as you wanted.
Right. So one thing I loved about the book was your sort of meandering attempt to understand that this thing that you actually name the book after and then figure out how to get one and how to use it.
Right.
What is a hot box?
So that's the thing. The hot box is the thing that makes... you know, restaurant quality food possible in food inappropriate spaces, like, you know, the vestibule at the New York Public Library, which is your kitchen. And it is an aluminum cabinet on wheels. But in most parts of the country, it's called a sheet pan cabinet. And it's usually used to transport large amounts of food from one chilled environment, like a walk-in, you know, to wherever it's being deployed in a big kitchen.
And it itself does not have built-in cooling or heating.
No,
right?
There's no plug. There's nothing. It's just a transport cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
And so
until you hack it.
Until you hack. And there, in the 70s, there was a guy named Jean-Claude Nedelec, who was the French chef at the Plaza Hotel in New York, and we did some history on how this happened. He was the banquet chef, and his banquet room was too far away from the kitchen that the food wouldn't be warm enough by the time he got it there. And so he hacked it with Sterno, with canned heat, mm-hmm. and realized that you can transform this aluminum cabinet into a warming oven of sorts.
And as long as you don't find a giant fire hazard.
As long as you don't
have a lot of smell, although eventually people start using the non-smelly stuff, right? Sterno, right?
Yeah. But this is the workaround that lets you do lots of food at scale. And it's a completely different method of cooking because everything is par cooked.
Mm-hmm.
And
in the prep kitchen.
In the prep kitchen.
Back of the gator.
Back of the gator type prep kitchen. And so the filets or the tenderloins or the lamb chops, it's like it's usually deep fried in a fryer to get a sear on it.
That's an amazing moment in the book. I could not believe that that was the case.
I just
assumed there was a grill back in headquarters.
Deep fried them 25 at a time, and they get that perfect, perfect color on them.
But they're still basically raw inside,
and then you chill them down. Mm-hmm. They spend the night in the walk-in. In the cooler, and then they get transported at 3 p.m. the next afternoon in that hot box to the site. Then they all get pulled, and those get transformed into an oven with Sterno. And
with a very precise calibration of Sterno cans in certain places,
exactly.
With plastic wrap and doors not quite
just
closed.
Right.
Just
yes.
So.
Yes. Yes. Because remember, the fire has to have oxygen, but just enough.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah.
The rookie move would be to shut the door of the proofer and snuff out all the Sternos and not notice.
Which your idiot brother actually did and caused you never get to be allowed.
We were never allowed to touch the
proofer. Right. I mean, only the most advanced.
Only the most senior people get to touch the proofers because, you know, there's beef tenderloin for 200 people in each one of them. And
yeah. There's no backup.
There's no backup.
Yeah.
That's the crazy thing is that the other thing that people don't realize when you scale up everything is the opportunity for disaster is exponential. And so we were just fascinated by, you know, here you are in these special events. Like special events catering, by definition, is the most momentous events in people's lives. It's the anniversary. It's the wedding. It's the gala. It's the movie premiere.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important, pregnant, emotional moments for people, and there's no room to fall down. And there usually are 600 people to witness whatever the failure is.
Mm-hmm.
And so who would choose to make their daily life going into this inferno
mm-hmm.
every night? I mean, that's the title Hot Box is meant to project that. It's not only the system that produces it, but like
mm-hmm. the environment.
This is the environment. And there were a lot of times, you know, so Matt and I ended up working 3 years for this company. And there were a lot of times when it would be so stressful that it would literally take me 2 days to recover just to process the amount of stress. And for me, I had the luxury to do that. Most of the people who I worked with had a shift the next morning because
mm-hmm.
a lot of them were working for one caterer at night and another during the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's for a lot of people who I worked, you know, there's two shifts in a catering firm, a prep shift and a fiesta shift.
Mm-hmm.
And the fiesta is the venue, the party.
The night shift.
And the prep shift is the commissary kitchen.
Yeah.
And the commissary kitchen is sort of like, that's, you know, it's more fun to work the fiestas. And the prep shift is more like daily work. Daily
grind. And the prep folks start at 40% of what the fiesta folks make, right?
Yes.
So it's,
yes.
it's more
$10 an hour for prep. Because they're more regular hours, they're more solid. And fiesta, they can migrate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's $25 an hour for fiesta. But you might work 3 hours at the Park Avenue Armory Gala and then get cut, so you're only working, you know.
Right. And so you talk about the stress. What were the top three most stressful moments that you witnessed on the job, including one where you were the cause of the stress and or the error?
Well, there were a couple parties that were just
mm-hmm.
stressful. But there was a wedding where my hors d'oeuvre would not set up. Like, mm-hmm. it was a tuile. It was 100 degrees out, 110% humidity. And a tuile is a very thin wafer cookie.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pressing foie gras mousse between two wafer-thin cookies.
Mm-hmm.
And it just wouldn't, you know, it just collapsed.
They just get
right. fail.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fail. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, it was anguish because, like, who would choose to put, mm-hmm. to serve this? 100 degree humidity day.
Could you just make it open face at that point, or
Or did you just scrap it?
I scrapped it because it was supposed to also balance like a Donald Judd sculpture, like on. I mean, it was, there was a lot going on. I mean, this is the other thing about catering. You know, catering is basically haute couture of food. If you customize a menu, you customize a location. It's like we bring it to you, and there's a lot of absurdity that goes with it, and of design, and it's usually insane budget. And there are a lot of times when you're just like, you know, a lot of people would say, well, why did you really care that you messed up the tuile? I mean, that's what my colleagues would say, like, why do you care? Because we just have to move on, actually, mm-hmm. you know, like the next course is coming and like whatever emotional thing you're going through, just leave it and mm-hmm. let's move on because we have to work.
So it's hard like that.
I wasn't really cut out for this kind of work, which kind of made me interested in it.
I mean, there's a lot of intense drudgery, too. I mean, what is it like to actually have to peel 800 hard-boiled eggs?
Yeah, no, it's, oh, my gosh. I mean, you literally do cut your fingers, basically. I mean, your fingers get raw and mm-hmm. sore and tear, you know. And if you don't watch out, you can cut yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But those were the kinds of things that I sort of needed to do and needed to experience to realize what, you know, this is like on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, so late in the book, you describe things from the perspective of a customer, or at least a consumer mm-hmm. of the finished mm-hmm. product. You say you were at the Whitney Gala in 2016, and you mm-hmm. describe in some detail a meal that just didn't work until the very end, by which point a lot of people have given up and left. You were there because your spouse had gotten invited somehow, and so you were and you were way too polite.
My artist, Whitney owns a good amount of her work, and we're uh-huh. invited to, she was in the biennial in 2000, so we're invited mm-hmm. there. So, yeah, you know, it's sort of like,
you're not going to tell us who the caterer was, huh? You're just going to be too polite to do that.
Oh, I absolutely will. I didn't in the book.
You did not in the book.
Because I actually didn't interview them, and so I didn't feel like it wasn't, it was a shop called Olivier Chang that does amazing work,
mm-hmm.
and they're,
but not that
for the great staffing, the great food, but it was one of those things where I eventually ended up what the issue was, and they were serving a piece of sashimi under glass.
Yeah, on the door.
Under a cloche, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they presented it with a lot of fanfare, like this thing, and you were seated, and they presented a cloche, you know, a bell jar, and you were looking at this piece of fish, and you were like, wow, what's under there? And they said, like, we'll take off the belt, you know, the waiter will be around to, and so they all came in unison to sort of take the
bowl.
Right. You know,
magic
what
trick.
I later found, because I talked to the event director, there was supposed to be a cloud of smoke underneath every bell jar.
Oh, and
right?
It failed.
And the fire marshal had said they couldn't do it.
Oh, God.
And so instead of saying, you know what, forget the bell jar, they went through with the bell jar without the smoke. So that's one of those things where it's like, did anyone really think through? You know, that's the thing. In the context of these parties, there's so much logistics. Uh-huh. And there are so many details when it's a gala and when these budgets are extravagant.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think, you know, it's nice that these extravagant galas employ so many people. You know, they employ leagues of artisans and workers and of all kinds.
Yeah.
But there is this way in which there's a holistic part to the point of this thing under glass. It's like, if this isn't going to work, why are we going to the trouble of renting? Because the rental for a bell jar that has to travel there and to make it, I mean,
right.
That's a whole other chapter in the book. It's a rental chapter.
Your statistics on breakage was incredible.
To ship a single bell jar to a site so that it doesn't break
uh-huh.
is probably like $6 a piece. And there were 600 people at that event.
For a $2 bell jar.
Right. For a $2 bell jar, it costs like $6 to ship it and not break it because you have to pack it and all this kind of stuff. And then to have it fail, forget it. I mean,
so the unsung heroes of this book, to my mind, were the Soto brothers. Immigrants from Mexico who were absolute masters of the hot box and everything else. As I read through this book, imagining, you know, in the era of TV, 2019, imagining who had already optioned this book and what was going to become of it. I'm imagining a reality nonfiction TV program starring the two of them as like the unsung catering badasses, right? Are we going to see them on the small screen soon?
The thing is, as we did with everyone who we worked with, we sort of left it open to them. Like, do you mm-hmm. want to be identified in this or not? It's up to you. Do you want? And they were like, no, we want. They love this. And they've gotten a lot of work based on this just by people who want that thing. They're throwing it hardy and they want to fix her.
Yeah.
And these are the guys who will bring in the labor and the people to make sure the party goes as planned.
Mm-hmm. But no TV deals yet?
It's in the works.
All right. And will they have their taco shop eventually? Because I want to go.
I know. That's the other thing is
Man still has no good tacos.
I know. It's crazy. We're going to do a family party together in the next couple weeks. And so we'll find out more about how that's proceeding. I mean, the other thing is these guys work so hard. They're already so booked.
Yeah, I'm sure they work 7 days a week and they have families.
So, and they have families and all the rest of it. And so they can't take on much more than they already do, but they're also trying to sort of develop a consulting business where they could, you know, big picture, just advise people on how to do this, because to the point about the bell jar, it's all in the planning.
Yeah.
And as long as you can organize and they do it. But we did really want to put a human face on it because it is a very invisible world. The reason why it's invisible is because all the attention at the party is focused on the celebrant.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be. It's their night.
Yeah. But not about the chef, the waiters in the restaurant.
Is there a way to make it humane still for the people who, and I think one way to do that about that is like, if you attend these parties, like, don't take for granted that there are people behind the scenes who are making this happen, and they do amazing work.
Yeah. So on that note, two quick questions before our time is up. First of all, other than stepping behind the pipe and drape and saying hello to the staff and expressing your gratitude, if you are a customer, what are a couple of things that you would tell listeners to do to ensure that they have a great event for whatever once-in-a-lifetime thing they're hiring catering for?
Here's the thing. Every event has a run of show, and it's a schedule by which the kitchen runs, right? So things happen to delay the run of show, which, you know, that it always happens. But the kitchen is running on that run of show. So the quality of your food depends upon the extent to which you, as a guest, might be able to make the event run more on time. So, for example, the waiters are tinkling. You know, usually there's a moment where someone's trying to get everyone's attention to sit down at the table. Sitting, that never happens. They usually budget 15 minutes to get everyone to sit. If someone's trying to get you to sit down at the table, sit down. Because the quality of the salmon depends on that. And, you know, if you don't care about the quality of the salmon, then fine. But please care about the quality of the salmon, because there are people who do. They're spending a lot of time and effort to make sure that it's perfect. So just, like, be attentive to those cues that you're getting from a service captain and obey them.
All right.
Like, the service captains are really empowered. Like, they do parties every night. They know how to be the connection between the kitchen. And just do, like, say thank you to the waiters. If you like the food, ask who the caterer is. I mean, just know, you know, I feel like books like No Reservations and Blood, Bones, and Butter, Gabrielle Hamilton's book, they made us sort of aware of how restaurants work. And just, I think a greater awareness of how a party works will make everyone, guest and labor alike, better off.
Right. So
better parties.
Parties. Things that we didn't used to know a lot about in terms of what happened behind the scenes that we now do, thanks to journalism. This passage from the introduction tickled my fellow scribe's heart, where you describe we're taking you into a world engineered never to be seen, populated by individuals you're never meant to hear from, performing needs you can't help but being curious about. And so the thing that I was curious about after reading that passage and then devouring the book is, what other hidden world in the food world or outside remain to be explained to the world, and you already have a book contract to do the next one? And if so, what is it?
It's funny, we're thinking about it, but there are several ways to go in this. I mean, you could slice the catering pie thinner, because we just did special events, but cruise ships are a whole other thing. And Patrick actually ended up doing, after he left Sonya and Castle, and between the time he opened his, you know, he's the main character, and he's sort of struggling with catering, and then he wanted to open, like, his taste menu restaurant in Richmond, which he ultimately does, but between that, he worked in a catering gig on a ship, and that's, like, this whole other thing.
Right, and there's no, what's the word, runbacks? Or
reruns.
Reruns.
Yeah.
You can't go back
to that. You can't go back to the
Yeah, and you probably can't pick up stuff in port.
Right.
People probably think you can, but you
limited,
probably can't.
You know, you basically go out there with enough meals for 300,000 people and all have to be fresh.
Oh, gosh, I agree with that.
So that's one, you know, so there are sort of things on the margins of large, you know, I took a class in how to run a food truck because I was just fascinated in that. I still think like people don't know, like it could probably be an article more than a book, but like it's super intense. It's not a lot of space and it has to, from a health code sanitation perspective, be very dialed in. And so that's an interesting sort of hidden kitchen that I've always been interested in. I think there are also other parts of the restaurant business. I feel like, and even my book maybe, like we've explored, like hovered around it, but I was recently party to a conversation between two partners in a restaurant, and they were having a conversation about lunch. And the chef believed that they should stay open for lunch, which they had since day one. They're 10 years in. And his partner, who's, you know, more the sommelier, the front of house beverage guy, he believed they shouldn't. That they didn't make money on it, and it didn't do anything for the bottom line, so they should close. That's an argument and a conversation that they have been having for 10 years, and they are still as close as they were from day one, if not more so. And, like, I never considered this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for the chef, he was like, well, we should stay open for lunch because it's a lower price point. So it allows a culture to come in that might not be able to afford the dinner service. We build a culture around that. And that was something I'd never considered as someone who dines out in restaurants all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so I think maybe that's restaurant business and maybe it doesn't have a mainstream audience, but I think that people don't consider how much value sort of a restaurant serves in bringing an environment and an atmosphere to bear. And I still think there are things that, as much time as I spend in restaurants, I still have yet to learn.
Yeah. So much left to explore, many more hidden worlds left to be found and explained to the rest of us. Ted Lee, class of 93, the name of the book is Hot Box. If you don't have it already, go buy it. Did you two narrate it yourself on
we
the audio
did.
Side?
We did.
So you can
so
hear
can
the
hear
famous
hear
Lee
the...
brothers out loud, you know, as you do your workout in the morning or commute to and from work. I cannot recommend it enough. Ted, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for doing this, Ron. I really appreciate it. And thank you, Amherst.